RNZ National, and on the weekend we're looking at some of the quirkier museums around the country. We've visited the Museum of Natural Mystery in Dunedin and the Elvis Presley Museum in Hawera. Well, this week we'd like to visit the New Zealand Cannabis Museum, but it's missing in action. Well, not quite. Whakamana, or the Cannabis Museum, is a mobile museum, and it really is wherever its founder, Abe Gray, hangs his hat, and he's in our Wellington studio. Kia ora, Abe.
Kia ora, how are you?
Not too bad. First things first, are you stoned now?
Actually, no, not at the moment. I thought I should, be extra coherent for this interview.
Fair enough. So you space it out, as it were.
Yeah, no pun intended. Look, I mean, I use cannabis very regularly, and it helps me with relaxation and insomnia. I mean, some people would consider that a recreational use. For me, the benefits outweigh any harms I experience, so I consider that therapeutic, and so does my GP.
Okay, so you're originally from Minnesota, and you came to New Zealand in 2002. Seeing this country, or New Zealand, as something of a mecca for stoners, but there was a reason for that, and there was an individual. Can you tell us who it was?
Yeah, so I had become aware of Nandor Tansos, the world's first elected practicing Rastafarian member of parliament, and that heyday in New Zealand from about around 1999 to 2002 was pretty well covered in the international cannabis media, High Times magazine, Cannabis Culture magazine, and for me as a naive 18-year-old, the tourism marketing that was just developing around Lord of the Rings at that time, you know, clean, green, 100% pure, plus this enigma of Nandor and the idea that, you know, someone who I saw as a role model could actually be elected into government and have an influence on the national drug policy. That was, you know, a revelation to me coming from American politics. George W. Bush, my first election was the Bush v. Gore presidential election. That was the first one I could vote in. And then it was kind of disregarded and decided by the Supreme Court. So the New Zealand MMP system seemed really promising to me, and I bought into the tourism marketing hook, line, and sinker. Of course, I didn't realize that there was another election happening in 2002, the same week that I arrived, and unfortunately, cannabis was a big victim to those coalition negotiations back then with Peter Dunn.
Yes, explain the political situation at the time.
So Nandor and the Greens had come in 1999, and actually the Greens had attempted to sort of play down Nandor's presence, and the Exclusive Brethren were sort of trying to do scaremongering about the Greens, and they did a leaflet drop, notoriously heavily concentrated around Coromandel, and they were basically highlighting Nandor Tansos and Sue Bradford and saying, if you elect the Greens, you're going to elect this crazy weed-smoking hippie and this, you know, beneficiary advocate. And that actually helped swing the election in the Greens' favor. And they only just sort of squeaked in on the specials, I believe. But it was sort of widely recognized that that anti-leaflet campaign spearheaded by the Brethren actually pushed them over the line. And so Helen Clark came in then as well. And they formed a coalition. Well, I think it was just Confidence and Supply. It wasn't a formal coalition. But part of that included a Health Select Committee review of the Misuse of Drugs Act. And that Select Committee review found that the harms that we associate with cannabis are actually harms that are caused by prohibition and the regulatory settings, you know, of criminal illegality, and not by cannabis itself. And so they recommended that there be some sort of move towards liberalization, decriminalization, or a review of the Misuse of Drugs Act. And so to my naive mind, sort of, you know, reading about this secondhand in cannabis magazines, it looked like legalization was imminent. They had, you know, had the experts come in and they found that the harms were caused by prohibition. This is sort of widely accepted now, but back then it was a bit controversial, but the experts had weighed in and there was a clear sort of mandate for action.
19 years later, the results of the cannabis referendum last year must have been a disappointment to you. Did you really feel it was going to get over the line?
Yeah, I mean, look, I arrived here thinking that everything was going to be done and I was just going to come to university and use my botany credentials to research, you know, cannabis plant biology. And of course, none of that happened. And I had to become an advocate because there was a sort of lack of people speaking up, even though we had kind of already won the argument and just had it taken away from us. And so I'm used to political defeats. There was a lot of stigma back then, and we've constantly faced it. And so to get as close as we did in the referendum is actually the least crushing political defeat I've ever experienced. So in a way, it's almost a win, if you know what I mean.
Why do you think it didn't go through?
Well, look, there's a lot of reasons. I mean, the heavy propaganda misinformation campaign coming again from extreme conservative religious sectors had a lot to do with it.
Can you give me an example of that?
The Family First driven Say Nope to Dope campaign, just totally, you know, focusing on outdated statistics and made up scare stories. I mean, the worst sort of resurrection of reefer madness that we could imagine. No one would ever get away with that in any other country. But they were out hard and early here, and no one really challenged them. And there was sort of this taboo in New Zealand about cannabis that's been so strongly enforced for the last 20 years that no one really stood up for cannabis. I mean, a few people did, the usual suspects, and a couple of, you know, important new voices. And then quite a few, you know, right at the very end. But the entrenched propaganda and the well-funded, organized no vote, you know, we were up against it. And right when the yes vote was about to sort of coalesce around a unified message and get the funding sorted was when COVID happened. So I don't want to make, you know, a COVID excuse, but that certainly didn't help. And if the yes vote side had been more organized and more coherent, I think it's safe to say we would have won. Basically, if anything had happened different in our favor, we would have won because it was only 1.5% difference. You know, that's basically the margin of error. So all we would have had to do is do one thing more slightly right, which I guess is frustrating. But as I said before, it's the best defeat we've ever experienced. And we now know that one out of every two people supports, you know, even just unjustified recreational use, let alone, you know, legitimate therapeutic use or, you know, terminal medical use.
What you've just said supposes that New Zealanders, or the majority of them, don't know anything about cannabis, but a lot of people cite mental health issues, saying that whilst it can make some people feel happy and relaxed, it can make others feel anxious and paranoid.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, some users have bad reactions. And like for any drug, you know, different people's biology is different and people are going to have different reactions. I mean, the problem we face with cannabis is there isn't just one cannabis. You know, cannabis is a plant and there's different varieties and it's a complex mixture of over 144 different cannabinoids and 200 terpenes. We talk about THC and CBD. And thankfully, that's been well covered and people kind of understand that now, the psychoactive versus the non-psychoactive. But there's a lot more to it. And the, you know, the nuances of people's reactions and the individual prospects, you know, for individualized medicine and recreation really revolves around understanding that cannabinoid profile and understanding the human biology better, our endocannabinoid system, which is the suite of over, you know, 50 different types of receptors distributed all throughout the body, you know, in the hundreds and thousands that are actually activated by these molecules. So we're only just scratching the surface of that. And that's why there's a lot of mixed messages and sort of, you know, horror stories, but also miracle stories as well, because, you know, there's stuff happening beyond the level at which we understand it, which science, thankfully, now is starting to pick apart because it's finally legal to actually study it in a university setting, you know, in some of these key jurisdictions.
Yes. And would you agree that if there was another referendum and it was for personal use and not a criminal conviction, that it may have got over the line quite easily?
Oh, totally. I mean, I think it was the commercial sale aspect that the no vote focused in on and that people were most anxious about. I mean, ironically, if you allow people to do it without a conviction, but you don't regulate the sale or have any sort of taxation, then it's much more of a free-for-all than was proposed in the bill. But I don't think people understood that. And I mean, we didn't do a good enough job educating. And I mean, part of that is, the museum was, our plan was to set up in Wellington all leading up to the referendum, you know, all of 2020, specifically as an interactive site to educate people, you know, one by one and en masse about these, you know, frequently asked questions about cannabis or misconceptions. And the fact that we didn't get to do that certainly hurt the cause. And clearly, we've got a lot more to do of that. And, you know, even as reform progresses, people are still going to have questions about cannabis. And I learn new things about cannabis every day.
Well, tell us about the Whakamana Cannabis Museum. It's had different locations simply because it's in your home, which many of these smaller museums are, and you can take the stuff with you. What's in it?
Well, let me just clarify. It's not in my home. When we first started out, it was in a flat. I never lived there.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I have a wife and children, and, you know, you can imagine the types of colorful characters that are attracted to a cannabis museum. So that wouldn't exactly work. But my colleague, who I co-founded the museum with, did live there originally. And as we expanded, we kind of grew out of the house and eventually moved to a commercial building where we had a cafe and a retail gift shop, rooms for accommodation, and even a nightclub in the basement where we had raves.
Yeah.
And then, unfortunately, I had to move from Dunedin, and I came to Christchurch. And we tried to keep the Dunedin Museum going, but there just wasn't any replacement person who wanted to show up there every day unpaid and, you know, was enthusiastic and intelligent about cannabis. And so we relocated to Christchurch, and we had the same sort of setup, you know, in a proper commercial building. And we actually attempted to do a Pledge Me crowdfunding campaign. And our proposal was to turn a historic church on the scale of the cathedral in Cathedral Square, actually just one block behind Cathedral Square, into like a Te Papa level cannabis educational experience. And that was going to cost $1 million. And unfortunately, we only got $215,000 pledged. So we didn't go ahead with that extravagant proposal. But ultimately, maybe that was good in hindsight because COVID hit right after that. But our sort of fallback plan after not doing the Christchurch expansion development was to come do a pop-up in Wellington, as I said, you know, for the year, like focusing on the referendum and trying to be, you know, right there across the street from Parliament, basically, to educate people and the lawmakers. And we were just about to sign a lease when the first COVID lockdown was announced. And then, of course, you know, our landlord was, you know, thrown into disarray with all their commercial properties and potential, you know, retail and hospitality subleases all had to question, you know, their numbers and stuff. So it really, you know, for a tourism hospitality business, it wasn't a great time. But the desire and demand for knowledge and education about cannabis is still there. And the expansion of cannabis and understanding of cannabis is growing globally. And so, you know, the reason for us existing hasn't gone away. And we're basically working as hard as we can to come back. I'm looking at a premises in Wellington later this week. And we're just trying to negotiate with the various parties, you know, to rebound now that everybody is finding their feet again after COVID. And, you know, I have no doubt that we'll be back in physical form in the, you know, early half of this year.
Okay, so when you are up and running again, what's in the museum?
Well, the most important sort of objects that we have, we have a whole lot of memorabilia. I mean, a bunch of it in archive storage, you know, never really seen by the public, you know, touching all aspects of the cannabis story globally and here in New Zealand. But probably the most important display that we have in every location that we've been is like the anatomy of the cannabis plant, like the plant biology. And I did my master's in botany and taught at the University of Otago for over a decade teaching botany. And so the museum kind of evolved out of that, my passionate cannabis activism, but then also my biology educator role. And so what people don't really understand is that cannabis is just the flower of the plant, really. And a lot of people attribute it to the leaf, but it's really just the flower of the female plant. And there's separate male and female plants. And then all the rest, the stem, the roots, the seeds, that's all hemp. And, you know, that can be made into various, you know, foods and textiles and advanced materials. And so just that one, you know, what is the difference between cannabis and hemp, to see a male plant and a female plant growing and in their sort of dried, you know, pressed botanical form, like a herbarium specimen, and to be able to look at a, you know, a real whole dried plant and see how the root connects to the stem and where the flowers are and what it looks like when it's growing. And then to understand, you know, that the stalk is where we get the fibers. It's like the bark is stripped from the stalk. And that's what the very first ropes and the very first clothing and, you know, ropes and pulleys and all of the very ancient human technology 10,000 years ago, that comes from cannabis. It was the very first fiber plant. And that's what we know as hemp today. And the seeds are a very nutritious food source. It was one of the first plants ever cultivated for agriculture by the human species. And it's only just this tiny part of the plant on only half of the plants that grow, the female plants, and it's just the very tip of those, the flower, that has these cannabinoids in it, you know, and potential psychoactive properties. So that's a real revelation for people. And then we also have a microscope where people can take those flowers and look at them under the microscope and see that it's only on the surface of those tiny flowers that there's these glands that sort of secrete droplets of essential oil. And that's what looks like the crystals on, you know, like shiny buds. And it's just those droplets of essential oil that contain the cannabinoids. And there's, you know, hundreds of chemicals in there, like I told you before. So that's probably the most important thing to understand. And, you know, someone can tell you all of that, but when you can touch and feel and interact and, you know, put something under the microscope and look yourself, then you can really more intuitively understand that for sure. Yeah, and we have a whole lot more objects. I mean, I could obviously go on for hours. We have a whole playable video arcade. The history of video games is intimately intertwined with stoners and cannabis. And, you know, there's 100 stories.
Okay. You better get ready to tell them all, because if you're going to get that up and running in the next couple of months, you've got a lot of work to do.
We sure do. But anybody who's interested, I'm easily contactable. And, you know, watch this space. We will be reemerging in one of New Zealand's major cities in a matter of months.
Where do we get hold of you, Abe, if someone does want to get hold of you?
I can just be emailed very easily, abe@r1.co.nz. And my phone number is published online. I'm easily contactable on social media.
Very good. Good to talk to you. And thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's Abe Gray in our Wellington studio, and it's the soon-to-be-resurrected Cannabis Museum. It doesn't actually exist right now.